Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to really dig into a pretty important case in corporate law.
Which one are we tackling?
It's the Delaware Supreme Court's 1993 decision in Nixon v. Blackwell.
Ah, yes. A classic.
It really is. And what I find so interesting about it is how it kind of pushes back against our gut feeling about fairness. You know, we tend to think fairness means treating everyone exactly the same.
Right. Equal treatment.
Exactly. But Nixon v. Blackwell really challenges that, especially when you're talking about closely held corporations.
It definitely does. It's one of those cases that forces you to think a bit harder about what fairness actually means inside a, well, a complicated company structure.
So for today's deep dive, our mission is really to get under the hood of this case. We want to understand the why behind the Delaware Supreme Court's thinking.
And pull out the key lessons, right? Especially for, say, law students listening in. What does this case tell us about the duties directors owe to different kinds of stockholders? We'll be looking at, you know, case briefs, analyses, basically piecing together the whole story.
Perfect. So let's set the scene. We've got a company called E.C. Barton & Co. It's a closely held corporation, kind of a family business story initially.
Founded by E.C. Barton himself.
But things get interesting after Mr. Barton passes away. The company's stock gets split into two different types. Can you break that down for us?
Sure. So E.C. Barton's estate plan set it up this way. Class A stock, which had voting rights, mostly went to the company's employees.
Okay, the insiders.
Right. And then there was Class B stock, non-voting, which largely went to his family members, the non-employees.
So right from the start, you've got this built-in difference, different shareholders, different rights.
Yeah, it's like the potential for disagreement was kind of baked into the structure from early on.
And that disagreement definitely flared up because of some specific things the company did later. One was setting up an ESOP, an employee stock ownership plan.
That's right. And they also bought key man life insurance policies.
Okay, let's unpack those. What did the ESOP do and why was it controversial?
Well, the ESOP essentially created a mechanism for employees who held company stock, mostly that Class A voting stock, to sell their shares back to the company or the plan.
Ah, so it gave them liquidity.
Yeah.
Way to get cash for their shares.
Exactly. Especially, you know, when they retired or if they left the company. It was a path to cash out.
And the key man life insurance. How did that fit in?
That's a similar idea, really. The company bought life insurance on key employees. The thinking was, if a key employee passed away, the insurance proceeds could give the company the money needed to buy back that employee's Class A shares from their estate.
So, again, providing liquidity, but specifically targeted at the Class A employee group.
Precisely.
Okay, so you can see the picture forming. The employee stockholders, the Class A folks, have these ways to turn their shares into cash.
Mm-hmm.
But the family members holding the non-voting Class B stock, they're kind of left out in the cold on that front. No similar options for them.
That was their argument, yeah. They felt stuck. They looked at the directors, many of whom were also employees and Class A stockholders, and said, hey, you're looking out for yourselves here.
Right. They claimed the directors breached their fiduciary duties, that they were discriminating against the Class B shareholders.
That's the core of the grievance. They argued these actions, the ESOP, the insurance, unfairly benefited the employees while leaving the family stockholders without a way to get value for their shares.
And initially, the lower court, the Court of Chancery, actually sided with them, didn't it?
It did, yes. The Chancery Court found these actions were sort of inherently unfair and even suggested the company should think about buying back the Class B shares too.
But then it went up to the Delaware Supreme Court, and they had a very different take.
A complete reversal, actually.
So what were the big legal questions the Supreme Court was really grappling with here?
There were really two core issues. First, did the directors actually breach their fiduciary duties by setting up these programs that benefited employee stockholders more directly?
Okay, the breach of duty question.
And second, maybe even more fundamental, does Delaware law actually require a corporation to treat every single stockholder exactly the same way all the time?
And the Supremes came back with a pretty resounding no to both, right?
That's right. A clear no on both counts. They found no breach of duty occurred, and they explicitly stated that equal treatment isn't the mandatory standard. The standard is fairness.
Fairness, not equality. That's the crucial distinction.
Absolutely. The court said fairness and equality just aren't the same thing in corporate law, especially not here.
Okay, this is where we really need to get into the weeds. The Supreme Court leaned heavily on something called the entire fairness standard. What is that and why did it apply here? Especially since the directors arguably benefited themselves.
Right. So entire fairness is Delaware's sort of super scrutiny test. It gets triggered when directors might have a conflict of interest, like when they're on both sides of a deal.
Which they were here, being employees and Class A owners benefiting from the ESOP.
Exactly. So the court says, okay, we can't just presume you acted correctly under the normal business judgment rule. You have to prove the transaction was entirely fair.
And how do they prove that? What are the parts of entire fairness?
It has two basic parts or prongs. First is fair dealing. That looks at the process. You know, how was the decision made? Was it negotiated fairly? Was there proper disclosure? How was it approved?
The procedural side.
Correct. And the second prong is fair price. That looks at the substance. Was the economic outcome fair to the corporation? Did the company get or give fair value?
So process and substance. Even though the Class B folks didn't get the same liquidity, how did the directors manage to convince the court that both the dealing and the price, the overall fairness, was met?
Well, the court looked closely at the context. A big factor was the founder's original intent.
E.C. Barton's plan.
Right. The court pointed out that Barton himself set up the two classes of stock voting for employees and non-voting for family. This suggested to the court that he intended to prioritize employee ownership and reward them for sticking with the company.
So the ESOP and insurance weren't just out of the blue. They aligned with that history.
That was the court's view. They saw these actions as serving a legitimate business purpose, keeping key employees motivated and loyal, ensuring continuity. And that purpose, they felt, was consistent with the founder's vision.
So the purpose wasn't discriminatory in itself, but rather a business strategy tied to the company's unique structure.
Exactly. And that ties into why the court pushed back so hard against the Chancery Court's idea of needing equal liquidity.
Yeah. Tell us more about that rejection. That seems key.
It was fundamental. The Supreme Court flat out rejected the idea that directors automatically have a duty to make sure all stockholders have the same ability to sell their shares.
Why not? It seems intuitively unfair if one group can cash out and another can't.
The court's reasoning was that different classes of stock come with different rights and expectations. That's the point of having different classes. Class B was non-voting from the start. The court basically said the Class B holders knew, or should have known, when they got their shares, that holding stock in a private, closely held company often means it's not easy to sell. Liquidity isn't guaranteed.
They sort of accepted that risk or that feature by holding that specific class of stock.
That's the implication. The court didn't see a duty to magically create liquidity for a class of stock that was structured differently from the beginning, especially when the actions benefiting the other class served a legitimate business goal tied to the founder's intent.
What about the business judgment rule? Does that still play a role when entire fairness is the main test?
It's related. The business judgment rule is the default standard, giving directors leeway if they act in good faith and are informed. Here, because of the conflict, the court applied the tougher entire fairness test.
Right.
But the court also noted that even under the less demanding business judgment rule standard, the director's decisions seemed rational and weren't grossly negligent. So the actions likely would have been okay even without the heightened scrutiny, which just further bolstered their conclusion.
So multiple layers of reasoning pointing in the same direction. No breach of duty.
Pretty much. If the directors act in good faith, the decisions have a rational business purpose that fits the company's history and structure, and the process is fair, then different outcomes for different stock classes aren't automatically a breach.
It really comes back to that quote you mentioned earlier from Chief Justice Veazey.
Yeah, it's worth repeating. Stockholders need not always be treated equally for all purposes. That really sums it up.
Powerful stuff. So let's think about the practical implications for our listeners, maybe law students or people involved with startups or family businesses. What are the big takeaways?
Well, for law students, Nixon v. Blackwell is crucial. It shows fiduciary duties aren't monolithic. They adapt to context, especially in closely held companies.
You need to understand the specifics.
Exactly. Know the rights tied to different stock classes. And when advising, don't just look at the outcome. Did everyone get the same thing? Look at the process. Was the dealing fair?
And for potential investors.
Caveat emptor to some extent. Buyer beware. If you're investing in a closely held company, especially as a minority holder with non-voting stock, do your homework. Understand the governance, the stock structure, and crucially, the potential lack of liquidity.
Because the law, particularly Delaware law after this case, gives directors significant discretion as long as they meet that fairness standard.
Right. Courts aren't there to guarantee equal outcomes. They're there to police for fairness.
So wrapping up the significance, Nixon v. Blackwell is really a landmark case because
it clearly draws the line between fairness and equality in closely held corporations. It reinforces deference to director judgment when actions align with legitimate business purposes and the company's context.
Like the founder's intent here.
Precisely. And it clarifies there's no automatic duty to provide equal liquidity, especially when stock classes are designed differently from the outset.
Okay, so the core message. Directors in these companies must be fair. But fair doesn't always mean equal. Context, purpose, and stock structure matter immensely.
That captures it perfectly.
Which leads to a final thought, maybe something for our listeners to ponder.
Yeah, if the standard is fairness, not equality, how should minority shareholders in these closely held setups actually protect themselves proactively? What does fairness look like in practice across different types of companies? And what tools do investors have beyond hoping a court sees things their way later?
Interesting. So thinking about shareholder agreements, specific rights.
Exactly. How do you define and secure fairness up front, knowing that the default legal standard gives directors a lot of room to maneuver? That's the ongoing challenge, isn't it?